Evening of the same day, the 23rd, and unbeknownst to the French, Dulles had written off Dien Bien Phu altogether. At 2200 Paris time, he sent a briefer message to Eisenhower, in which he acknowledged that the situation here is tragic, but in which he also affirmed that there is, of course, no military or logical reason why loss of Dien Bien Phu should lead to collapse of French. That assessment was correct, inasmuch as only 4% of the French battle force in Indochina was committed at Dien Bien Phu, but it seemingly did not take cognizance of such aspects as French and Vietnamese combat morale or of the war weariness of French public opinion at home. If Dulles, on April 23rd, failed to understand what was at stake at Dien Bien Phu, then this is simply one more example of the limitations of many a diplomat in assessing the non-material aspects of a given political problem. On April 24th, Eden had also arrived in Paris for the NATO Council meeting, and Admiral Radford personally undertook to convince him of the necessity of at least providing the United States with a symbolic declaration of support. Eden, however, remained adamant and told his American interlocutors that, as in Korea, a policy predicated on airstrikes would soon thereafter be followed by commitments of ground troops on the part of the United States. And, as experience had shown, such a commitment would again be followed by American pressure on the Allies for united action, meaning the commitment of their troops to the battle. The British were grimly determined to give Geneva its chance, and Eden flew back to London on Saturday, April 25th, to attend a special cabinet meeting to settle the problem once and for all. All attempts at saving Dien Bien Phu through an American airstrike collapsed that weekend. But it remained to put the finishing touches on the historical record all around and to go through the final diplomatic motions. On April 24th in the afternoon, Secretary John Foster Dulles sent Bidull a memorandum drawn up in the course of a meeting at the American Embassy in Paris, whose first sentence, retranslated from the French, makes interesting reading in 1966. An act of war can only be effected with authorization of Congress. The rest of the letter simply reaffirmed the earlier American position and added to it the new fallback position that, in fact, Dien Bien Phu was not terribly important, could no longer be saved by airstrikes, and in any case already had cost the enemy dearly. Bidault's reply, also dated the same day, began by restating the already known arguments, but added to them the fact that the heavy concentration of the enemy's battle force in the immediate Dien Bien Phu area would permit devastating airstrikes, which would not only save Dien Bien Phu, but could well alter the overall balance of the war. There remained one last try, a direct confrontation between the French and the old British leader. It took place in London on Tuesday, April 27th. The Western missions had already arrived at Geneva for the purpose of discussing the Korean and Indochinese questions with the Communist bloc. Later in the morning, René Massilly, the French ambassador to the Court of St. James's, was received by Churchill, but Churchill remained adamant. Britain would not let an opportunity go by at settling the outstanding issues of peace and war with the Communist powers for the sake of a small garrison, whose fate, in all likelihood, was sealed anyway. "Let us not be shaken in our resolution," said the old leader. "I have known many reverses myself. I have held out against them. I have not given in. I have suffered Singapore, Hong Kong, Tobruk. The French will have Dien Bien Phu." That afternoon, Churchill told a cheering House of Commons that Her Majesty's government was not prepared to give any undertakings about United Kingdom military action in Indochina in advance of the results of Geneva. Operation Vulture died a slow death. Brigadier General, later Major General Caldera, the commander of the B-29 group at Clark Field, made one more visit to Indochina on April 26th, still for the purpose of preparing a variant of the American air raid on Dien Bien Phu. That last variant allegedly provided for 80 plane raids during 3 consecutive nights on the surroundings of the valley of Dien Bien Phu and on the Communist depot area at Tuan Jiao, this time with mixed American-French crews. Here again, sub-variants seem to have been discussed, involving more accurate daytime raids flown by mixed crews in aircraft bearing the French tricolor. The whole operation was still set to go on a 72-hour alert basis, and a senior French Air Force officer from Saigon had already left for Clark Field to prepare the operation. Perhaps everything was not yet lost. The final act of that tragedy was an entirely American one. In a dramatic meeting between Eisenhower, Radford, the service chiefs, and several other high-level officials on April 29th in Washington, the whole situation was reviewed once more. Of the military present, only Admiral Radford was still in all-out favor of even a unilateral American commitment to stave off defeat at Dien Bien Phu. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Robert D. Kearny, and the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Nathan B. Twining, were unenthusiastic about the operation, but General Matthew B. Ridgway, the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, was dead set against the whole idea. As the former commander of United States forces in Korea, Ridgway had a clear idea both of the limitations of air action under such circumstances. In Korea, Operation Strangle, designed to knock out communist communication lines, had been a dismal failure. But he also felt, like Sir Anthony Eden, that the airstrikes would in all likelihood be followed by a commitment of large American ground forces to yet another inconclusive and costly war on the mainland of Asia. A Blue Ribbon U.S. Army team had been sent by Ridgway to Indochina earlier that year, and it had returned appalled by the conditions under which U.S. forces would have to operate in case of a ground war there. In this he was fully backed by Lieutenant General James M. Gavin, the noted airborne commander of World War II fame, and in 1954 the Chief of Research and Development in the Pentagon. More than anyone else, Gavin knew how poorly the United States was prepared for a limited land war in Asia, and he considerably strengthened Ridgway's adamant stand against a policy which, in his view, would lead the United States into such a situation. In 1966, the now-retired General Gavin still held the same view and expressed it publicly with regard to committing U.S. forces in Vietnam, and the also-retired General Ridgway in turn backed him. As the noted military historian Hanson W. Baldwin reported later, Charles E. Wilson, the Secretary of Defense at the time, backed Ridgway and Gavin, and for once, President Eisenhower stood his ground against Dulles and the other service chiefs. The decision not to come to the help of the French was about to become final. The chips now were down. Time stood still for a very brief moment, not only in Washington, but also at Dien Bien Phu. There, on April 29th, the French lines were holding on the Five Hills, on the southern Huguettes, and on Strongpoint Wheam. Thanks to airdropped replacement parts, there were still 19 French 105s. In Hanoi, the 1st BPC stood ready to be dropped into Dien Bien Phu as reinforcement, and giant American C-124 Globemasters from the 322nd Air Division were in the process of airlifting into Indochina the brand new 7th BPC. India, fearful of being accused by Red China and Russia of helping the hard-pressed French, refused to let the American aircraft fly over Indian territory or stop for refueling there. The lumbering planes had to make a vast detour over the Indian Ocean and refuel in Colombo, Ceylon, which did not raise similar objections. With part of the enemy artillery obliterated through air raids, and with fresh troops thrown into the battle as constituted units instead of being dribbled in, there still was an infinitesimal chance of surviving long enough to be saved from defeat by a ceasefire. After all, that is what had happened to the encircled Egyptians at Fallujah in 1948, when they were saved from utter destruction by the Israelis through a ceasefire imposed by the UN. If that had not happened, Colonel Nasser would have been an Israeli prisoner of war. And with the communist depots at Tuan Jio badly mauled, the Viet Minh infantry divisions at Dien Bien Phu would have been, in the middle of the monsoon season, in danger of starvation. That was what, 1 year earlier, had prompted the Viet Minh's 308th Division to withdraw from its attack on the Laotian royal capital of Luang Prabang. With or without Britain's approval, the operation was still feasible and also militarily useful. The decision now was entirely Eisenhower's. That decision, of course, was negative, but, curiously, that is never mentioned in the President's memoirs. Instead, he offers an explanation of the considerations that moved him, which still has a bearing on the situation in Vietnam 12 years later. During the course of this meeting, I remarked that if the United States were, unilaterally, to permit its forces to be drawn into conflict in Indochina and in a succession of Asian wars, the end result would be to drain off our resources and to weaken our overall defensive position. If we, without allies, should ever find ourselves fighting at various places all over the region, and if Red Chinese aggressive participation were clearly identified, then we could scarcely avoid, I said, considering the necessity of striking directly at the head instead of the tail of the snake, Red China itself. Therefore, not to attempt to save the French at Dien Bien Phu was ultimately, as it should have been, a wholly American decision, and at the highest level, involving the senior congressional leaders, the Joint Chiefs, and the President. Yet, almost as soon as the decision had been made, there began a hardly subtle process of blaming the whole failure of Vulture on Britain. Secretary Dulles personally stated on a nationwide telecast on June 12, 1954, that like Secretary of State Henry Stimson in the case of Japan's aggression against China in 1931, his own attempts at saving Indochina through united action had been rebuffed by the Allies. Commenting on that rationalization the following day, James Reston in the New York Times stated that, "This picture, omitting any reference to congressional or White House opposition to using force in Asia, either in 1931 or 1954, is one of the most misleading oversimplifications ever uttered by an American Secretary of State, but it allocates blame and furnishes an alibi." And in his own incisive article on the subject, Chalmers Roberts noted that, regardless of Allied action or inaction, Congress would in all likelihood have given the President the requested mandate, provided he had asked for it forcefully and explained the facts and their relation to the national interest of the United States. But the fact emerges that President Eisenhower never did lay the intervention question on the line. That is precisely what Lyndon B. Johnson, perhaps mindful of his own action of April 1954, did not fail to do in 1964 and 1965. The American failure to make an early decision, one way or the other, with regard to Operation Vulture, was to dog the Eisenhower administration in curious ways, even after the death of John Foster Dulles. The article in Life magazine of January 1956, which gave rise to the term brinkmanship, and in which Dulles deliberately laid the blame once more at Britain's feet, and even claimed that, prior to Geneva, his policy of boldness impressed the communists and permitted the French Prime Minister and Eden at Geneva to bargain from Dulles's strength, raised such a storm of protest as to require the Secretary of State to devote a full press conference to defending it. When, after the death of Secretary Dulles, the first volume of memoirs of Sir Anthony Eden was published, it included several documents flatly contradicting the official American position. President Eisenhower himself, on January 13, 1960, further compounded the earlier confusion existing about Operation Vulture by affirming that there was never any plan developed to put into execution in Indochina. The President then dismissed all the efforts his late Secretary of State in March to April 1954 had made to hammer out a joint position for intervention at Dien Bien Phu by saying that Dulles had been a very forceful man. He couldn't very well talk about possibilities that might by then be considered as proposals, when they were not meant as that at all. Obviously, by the time his own memoirs were published in 1963, the President had had time to recollect his thoughts on the matter and to adopt a viewpoint that was somewhat less inconsistent with the actual facts. On April 18th, in a message sent via his personal code, Elie approved the forces, immediately flashed the fact of definite failure of Vulture to Navarre, and Navarre immediately drew the full implication of that fact for the garrison of Dien Bien Phu. Operation Condor already was underway, but the new situation required more desperate measures. By top-secret telegram number 24, sent in his own personal code, Navarre informed Elie on April 30th that he was now studying a sortie of the garrison in direction of Laos, which presents enormous difficulties and will, under the best of circumstances, save only a part of the personnel. It will be inevitable to abandon the wounded. That last-chance operation will be dubbed Albatross. Fortunately, only a very few Frenchmen are conversant with the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. During this interval, one of the most bizarre byplays of the whole war was taking place between Navarre and Elie. One of Navarre's intelligence officers had established contact with a member of Ho Chi Minh's government. This event was so secret that Navarre had requested and obtained permission not to mention the whole matter to the highest French civilian representative in Indochina, Commissioner General Maurice Dejean. On April 18th, in a message sent via his personal code, Elie approved the pursuing of the contact, but urged Navarre to use maximum care to avoid being trapped by the enemy. Elie also told him to consult the government in Paris before making any commitment, and confirmed that Navarre should withhold the information from the Commissioner General's office, which was widely known for its leaks. Navarre's reply of the following day was short and to the point. "I took no initiative. Contacts are top secret. My representative can always be disavowed. No results expected before 1 week." What happened next, and who exactly that high-level North Vietnamese contact was, is still not known publicly to this day. But he did exist, and he was important, for on May 12th, after Dien Bien Phu had fallen and the Geneva Conference had begun, Navarre radioed to Elie, "Viet Minh contact, now with Viet Minh delegation at Geneva. Everything is off. Talks may resume if Geneva fails." There was a 6-man Viet Minh delegation at Geneva. Pham Van Dong, then foreign minister, now the prime minister of the Hanoi government, Tha Quang Bu, an Oxford-trained brigadier general, Ha Van Lau, a People's Army colonel who since 1954 has been in charge of Hanoi's relations with the International Control Commission, Phan An, a college professor and holder of several senior posts in Ho's government since 1945, Wang Van Hoen, then ambassador to Peking, and Trong Khong Tuong, then vice minister of justice and a trained lawyer. It could have been any one of them, but there was no need of resuming the secret contacts. Geneva did not fail, after all. Initially, Condor had been planned as early as December 1953 as an operation designed to pursue, in connection with the French forces at Dien Bien Phu, Viet Minh siege troops supposedly dislocated by a successful French defense of the valley. In its original form, the plan provided for 4 phases. Phase 1, a group of 4 battalions would destroy the communist regulars south and west of the Namu River on a 30-kilometer front between Muang Qua and Pak Luang. Phase 2, the Condor force would then repeat the operation undertaken by GAP-2 in December 1953. Phase 3, it would progress to Hue Nhanya Song, where it would link up with an airborne battle group of between 3 to 4 battalions to be reinforced by a 75mm recoilless rifle battery from the 35th Airborne Artillery and a company of the 17th Airborne Engineers. Phase 4, the 8-battalion force would then move in direction of the valley of Dien Bien Phu. At the beginning of the third phase, it would conquer and hold the Col de Calcaire, Limestone Pass, between Tay Chang and Ban Nai Thi. Upon holding Limestone Pass, the task force would be overlooking the southern flank of Dien Bien Phu and probably see Isabel. The plan also provided for a variant in case it proved inadvisable to parachute an airborne group on Hue Nhanya Song, or in case communist resistance west of Limestone Pass did not require the presence of the paratroopers. In that case, the airborne group would be parachuted south of Isabel once the ground troops had secured Limestone Pass. That variant, in order to stay consistent with the other bird-like codenames, was given the codename of Piver, Woodpecker. The total number of troops to be involved in that original version of Condor was to be about 5,500. The trouble with that plan was that it required, just as the original Operation Castor had, about 115 Dakotas a day, or about half that many C-119s, and the daily maintenance of that force, in view of the practically non-existent roads, required 60 tons of airborne cargo space, or the equivalent of 24 Dakotas, not to mention the fact that those 60 tons would have to be rigged into 600 separate 100-kilogram parcels every day. An operation of that size, in addition to the daily feeding of Dien Bien Phu, even at minimal levels, simply would have broken the back of the whole air transport effort. In other words, in order to be successful, Condor depended as much on vastly increased American air transport as Vulture depended on American bombers. Hence, when it became clear that Condor would become not an operation to pursue an already defeated enemy, but a last-ditch attempt to save Dien Bien Phu from total destruction, its basic structure was completely changed during the last week of April 1954. At a conference of senior commanders in Saigon on April 28, the airborne phase of the operation was vastly scaled down, if not eliminated altogether, since the available paratroop battalions would in all likelihood be parachuted into Dien Bien Phu itself. On the other hand, the modified plan now provided for a ground task force of 4 infantry battalions reinforced by the shadowy infiltrated command groups of the GCMA. Here again, it had to be the sorely tried commander of air transport, Colonel Nicot, who threw cold water on even the scaled-down plan. His mathematics were absolutely impeccable. The NBN Fu required 150 tons of airborne cargo space a day, and the revised version of Condor still needed 45 tons daily. The other problem in that connection was that the bulk of the C-119s were flown by American civilian crews who had not been initially hired to fly into such a death trap as the doomed valley. There was at the end of April a very good chance that the Americans would suddenly refuse to fly combat-type missions, and in fact that situation arose suddenly between May 2nd and 6th when both the American and the French civilian crews refused to fly supply missions to Dien Bien Phu unless proper amounts of fighter escort were provided. Nicot, on April 28th, was fully aware of that situation, which meant that he could lose, at a moment's notice, almost one-half of his available transport tonnage. By a fantastic juggling of priorities, Nicot finally agreed that he could provide both Dien Bien Phu and Condor with their minimal supply tonnage if all of Indochina were to be completely stripped of air transport for 6 days, save for two C-47s left for the southern Laotian airhead at Seno. But the first phase of Condor already had been underway since the day General Navarre had met Colonel de Crèvecoeur at Seno 2 weeks earlier. Contrary to assertions later made by such diverse sources as Jules Roy, who asserted that Condor was more or less a sham, and President Eisenhower, who stated in his memoirs that it merely involved one relief column of 300 native troops who had made a feeble effort to rescue Dien Bien Phu, Condor, on the ground at any rate, was clearly organized to fulfill at least part of its mission. Colonel de Crèvecoeur had given overall command of Condor to Colonel Thenn. The latter had at his disposal, as of April 13th, the 4th and 5th Battalions of Laotian Chasseurs, BCL, the 1st Laotian Airborne Battalion, BPL, the 2nd Battalion of the 2nd Foreign Legion, 22REI, whose 1st Battalion under Major Clemenceau was inside Dien Bien Phu, and the commando groupment of Lieutenant Colonel Mola, comprising more than 800 Laotian and Mayo tribesmen, for a total of 3,088 men, including 1,682 Laotians. The infantry force, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Godard, was officially known as Mobile Group North, GMN. It was subdivided into two separate forces, Subgroup East, under Major Coquelet, 5th BCL and 1st BPL, and Subgroup West, commanded directly by Godard, 4th BCL and 22REI. By April 21st, Colonel Thenn had worked out his modified plan for Condor. As a first step, in order to give Dien Bien Phu a measure of respite, his deployment would be so constructed as to attract, between April 25th and May 15th, a maximum of Communist forces to the north flank of the Namu. Once Communist forces had been distracted in that direction, the GMN would leave a light curtain of commando forces on that front, while the bulk of the force would bypass the well-known track to Dien Bien Phu via Limestone Pass and instead swing in the direction of Isabel along a more southern route through Muang Hep. If provided there with four infantry battalions, Colonel Thenn hoped to be able to reach Strongpoint Isabel about May 25th. In order to further confuse the Viet Minh as to the actual strength of his force, he requested that the French High Command airlift into him small detachments from French units available in other areas of Indochina. Like John Le Carré's spy who came in from the cold, these detachments would be deliberately deceived and led to believe that they constituted the advance guard of their own units, which were to be moved to Laos as part of a Condor force. As members of these detachments became casualties or fell into communist hands, enemy intelligence would be fooled, at least for a time, as to the exact strength and location of the French units. Soon, small single-engine Beavers and Nordheims began airlifting those French detachments to frontline units all over northern Laos to be deliberately offered up to the enemy as decoys. There later was some evidence that, up to a point, the ruse worked. Finally, Thenn also requested two airborne battalions. There still existed the 1st and 3rd BPVNs, whom Longley did not want inside Dien Bien Phu, and for the airlifting in of ground units on some of the existing small fields, he requested C-47s, which would be equipped with additional JATO, jet-assisted takeoff engines, to enable them to use the short strips. While Condor began to take shape on paper, its actual execution on the ground was running into trouble. The operation was to take place at a time of brutal heat, and in an area which, even during the monsoon season, was extremely arid. on April 17th at 1340, then had informed Navarre that it was impossible to find 500 human porters, even by force, since much of the population had fled into the mountains, and that 150 mules and the proper pack saddles for them, which were of key importance for logistical transport, also were not available. There also was an important requirement for jerry cans to carry water and for inflatable life rafts to cross the numerous streams. Navarre ordered the airlifting of mules and 500 Vietnamese PIMs into the assembly area, thus adding to the problems of Colonel Nicot's air transport plans. In the meantime, however, Godard had begun to execute Phase 1 of Condor. The 2-2 REI had begun to move northward along the Namu, and on April 21st had intercepted a large communist cargo pirogue carrying 81mm and 120mm mortar ammunition. The three captured prisoners explained that they belonged to Company 230, 72nd Battalion, 80th People's Army Regiment, which was composed of 1,200 Lao-speaking Vietnamese and 500 Laotians. On the following day, the Godard force discovered a communist ammunition depot at Hat Dinh, containing American mortars, Czech automatic rifles, submachine guns, cartridges, and 205 rucksacks. On April 23rd, the Legionnaires established a bridgehead north of the Namu between Hat Dinh and Pak Noir. Pak Noir was a small village at the junction of the Namu and the smaller Nam Noir tributary, and at Ban Loi, 35 kilometers to the northeast, an even smaller river joined the Nam Noir, the Nam Yum. From there, it would only be another 15 kilometers to Dien Bien Phu. On April 22nd, intercepted Viet Minh radio messages showed that the enemy knew about the unleashing of Condor, first reported by Regiment 148 2 days earlier, and that it had correctly identified the purpose of the operation. The radio traffic also confirmed Colonel Thein's surmise that the communists expected airdrops on Nha Nha Song and Sop Nau, the two towns through which Long Le had passed in December 1953 and which were on the most direct road to Dien Bien Phu. There also were indications that parts of Regiment 148, Battalion 940 of the 82nd Regiment, and elements of Battalion 970 of the 316th Division had received orders to stay put and screen the Dien Bien Phu front against the Condor force. Subgroup East also had not remained inactive. On April 25th, the 1st BPL fell upon that rarity, a Viet Minh fixed strongpoint 2 kilometers south of the important river town of Muang Qua. It took the strongpoint and captured an important booty, including 37 boxes of ammunition and 500 mortar fuses. But the heat was brutal. On that day, the battalion reported 3 deaths from sunstroke. On April 29th, the 2 prongs of GMN were joined at Muang Qua itself. Like all the towns of the Namu Valley thus far occupied, it too had been completely pilfered, and most of the population was suffering from hunger. The commandos also had not remained inactive. Equipped to move lightly, Lieutenant Colonel Mollat's whole headquarters was composed of 1 other officer and 3 sergeants. They already had moved ahead deeply into Viet Minh territory. They were split into 3 small groups. Group A, under Lieutenant Mesnier and 3 sergeants, consisted of 320 men. Group B, commanded by Lieutenant Vang Pao, a Mayo tribal leader and a regular French officer, also comprised about 300 men. In the 1960s, Vang Pao, eventually promoted to general in the Royal Laotian Army, was to operate with the American Special Forces in the same area and would be one of the very few Laotian officers to give a good account of himself in guerrilla warfare. Finally, Group C was composed of 200 tribesmen and was commanded by Sergeant Marceline. There also existed a separate reconnaissance commando, No. 610, under Captain Lustreau, whose job it was to collect intelligence for the French High Command. In addition to the Mollat command force, there existed in the area the already infiltrated GCMA outfits that were directly subordinated to the French High Command in Saigon. Commanded by a lowly Lieutenant Colonel, Roger Tronquier, they had progressively taken on greater importance over the past 2 years and now numbered close to 15,000 men, dispersed in small units all the way from the rubber tree forests northwest of Saigon to the Chinese border. Some, such as the already mentioned Cardamom, had been in existence for a fairly long time. Others, such as those operating in the spring of 1954 in Laos, were fairly recent. They were the ones who now screened ahead of the whole Condor operation and who eventually would pick up the few escapees from Dien Bien Phu and then stay put behind communist lines to the bitter end. Among the GCMA units involved in Condor and Albatross were Group Alpha, a 300-man force operating from Unaoa in northernmost Laos, Gamma, with 650 men, infiltrated west of Muang Thae in the northwestern corner of Vietnam, Grapefruit, which operated around Ban Nam Luang, 15 kilometers southeast of Limestone Pass, Banana, stationed near Hat Sa on the Namu River, and finally Areca Tree, in the hills south of Nha Song. As of April 21st, Godar had been in touch with Grapefruit, which was operating ahead of him, and would stay with the force until May 8th, and Areca Tree informed the Condor force as of April 29th that the drop zone at Nha Nha Song was secure and could be used for airdrops. In other words, everything was ready for a successful execution of the second phase of Condor. To be sure, the troops had been plagued by extremely harsh conditions. The heat had become so intense that the units had to fight their way through extensive forest fires and finally resorted to night marches. But the prospect of marching forward and, at the very least, of bringing a measure of relief, if not salvation, to the hard-pressed defenders of Dien Bien Phu made them go on. But elsewhere, where the fate of the war was being decided, things stood otherwise. On April 22nd, at 20:00, Nabar sent a top-secret message to his deputy commander-in-chief, General Baudet, who was then in Hanoi, informing him that the execution of the second phase of Condor would be delayed until further order, and then would be subject to advance notice of 5 days. Even the pursuit of Phase 1 would be subject to further messages. Explanation for the delay was never quite clearly given, but a top-secret personal flash message sent by Nabar to Colonel de Crèvecoeur on April 29th seems to come close to the truth. In that message, Nabar told the commander of French Union forces in Laos that the bad meteorological conditions over Dien Bien Phu had made it impossible to provide the fortress with the necessary supply levels, without further cuts in the airborne tonnage required to supply the forces of Lieutenant Colonel Godard. That killed all chances of parachuting in a complete airborne group, at the earliest, according to Nabar, that GAP could not be made available before 7 to 8 days. Under such conditions, added Nabar, I leave you to judge. Strange situation indeed, where a lieutenant general leaves a lowly colonel in charge of deciding the fate of a whole operation. After an exchange of messages with his subordinate commanders, Colonel de Crèvecoeur decided to at least hold his own for the time being. With the key airborne reinforcement ripped clear out of Condor, the operation completely changed in character, and, in order to confuse the enemy, the modified operation was given the name of an extremely mountainous French district, Ariège. Far from advancing further in direction of Dien Bien Phu, Mobile Group North was now ordered to establish a defensive position on the north side of the Namu. Commando Group Areca Tree abandoned the drop zone at Nha Nha Song on May 2nd, and the 5th BCL, which had been in contact with Company 221, Battalion 910 of People's Army Regiment 148 since April 27th, and which had managed to capture 15 rifles at the price of losing 10 radio sets, fell back to the Namu during the night of May 3rd, screened by Commando Group Banana. On May 6th, Grapefruit reported a firefight with Viet Minh forces near its operations area, and reported at 1300 the following day that the inhabitants of Ban Nam Luang said that 10,000 Viet Minh soldiers from the Dien Bien Phu siege force were expected to move soon from the valley into Laos. In all likelihood, it was a reconnaissance force from Grapefruit that was watching the agony of Dien Bien Phu from the edge of the valley, although this cannot be fully confirmed at this time. At 10:20 of May 7, 1954, a few hours before Dien Bien Phu fell, de Crèvecoeur sent a message to General Cogny in Hanoi, asking him that he be immediately informed by flash radio message in case of grave event concerning GONO. Cogny replied a few hours later by providing de Crèvecoeur with a code phrase, which, in the form of the so-called personal messages sent by the BBC during World War II to the European resistance forces, would be transmitted in clear, so as to be sure that all units concerned would be informed in time. The code phrase covered the fall of Dien Bien Phu itself, but did not provide any guidance for further actions to be taken by the Condor force. As Hanoi explained it to the French commander in Laos, whose troops in the Dien Bien Phu area were under tactical control of General Cogny, that action would be an immediate and complete retreat at utmost speed, abandoning everything, for there would be no help, no air support, no reinforcements, until Godard's troops reached the already established airhead at Muang Sai, almost 85 miles downstream from Muang Khoa. By the sort of tastelessness to which military staffs are prone when they run out of ideas, that ignominious retreat was given the codename of Emperor Napoleon's most shining victory, Austerlitz. On May 8th at 1305, all elements of Operation Ariège heard the code phrase, "The fruit are ripe." Dien Bien Phu had fallen. A few minutes later, there also flashed the second part of the message, Austerlitz. A few minutes later, a little Moran cricket from the 23rd Air Observation Group at Muang Sai dropped a written copy of the withdrawal order onto the command post of Lieutenant Colonel Godard. Almost simultaneously, the outposts began to report heavy enemy contact in several places at once. Fortunately, Godard had had one day's advance warning and had begun to mine the trails leading away from the Namu. With the 5th BCL acting as rear guard, the Condor force began to fall back, leaving the mines set to go off at 10-minute intervals. And again, Godard did the correct thing in jungle warfare, a rule that seemingly is forgotten only too often in South Vietnam in recent years. Instead of retracing his own earlier steps, he ordered his column to hack a new trail across the hills at Quang Rip. The Viet Minh, expecting the French to retrace their own steps, had sent an ambush force ahead of them, which was to close in on the old path on May 10th. Instead, the French column passed the ambush point during the night of May 8th to 9th, thus for once catching the Viet Minh off balance. In the ensuing firefight, the 4th BCL was badly mauled, losing almost two companies. The 5th BCL also had some losses, but the rest of the Condor force returned to the strongpoint zone with no further losses, but with a bitter taste in the mouth. Even the very restrained official reports speak of the bitterness of the officers and troops of Lieutenant Colonel Godard, who had suffered extreme hardships for the sake of their comrades at Dien Bien Phu, and who felt that the Northern Command in Hanoi, for selfish reasons, had deprived them of a chance to help their comrades at a moment of dire need. One-fourth of the total strength of the 1st Laotian Airborne Battalion deserted after the battle was over, and another 67 men deserted from the 4th BCL, and thus ended the last-ditch attempt at saving Dien Bien Phu from the outside. The failure of Condor also determined the failure of Albatross. Officially, Navarre entrusted the preparation of the breakout attempt to the operations staff of General Cogny only on May 3, 1954. While the details of the operation, and above all, the exact date of it, were left to the discretion of General de Castries, the overall outline of Albatross was as follows. The general direction of the breakout was to be southeastward in the direction of Muang Na and Muang Hilp, with French screening forces from Laos to be pushed in that direction at the very last moment in order to avoid detection by the Viet Minh. The breakout of the garrison from the battle line inside the valley was to be supported with a maximum effort of all artillery pieces and mortars still available, and all combat aircraft. All wounded would be left behind, and all lightly disabled soldiers would provide fire cover for the men of the breakout force. The breakout would take place at the end of the day in order to permit the troops to reach forest cover very rapidly. Only hand weapons and 4 days' combat rations would be carried. The minimal estimate for the arrival in place of the various elements of Condor was then estimated at May 15th. When General Cogny in turn communicated the basic outline of Albatross to General de Castries in a long radio message on May 4th, that estimate had already been stretched to May 20th, and Cogny added in a last paragraph that it was well understood that until further orders, the commander of GONO will consider his mission to be to resist on the spot without thought to falling back. On May 5th at 1615, de Castries answered Cogny, "The tracks leading to the south do not permit a sufficiently rapid flow-through for 6,000 men. The only thing that is feasible is the simultaneous breakout in various directions. In view of the difficulties in preserving secrecy even when using code, I insist upon not revealing my intentions. I must ask you to trust me." The whole concept of Albatross found a great many critics in Hanoi. Cogny's chief of staff, Colonel Bastiani, went on record that, given the difficulties of the terrain, the strength of the enemy, and the state of total exhaustion of the garrison, Albatross would only result in a complete rout, and in the piecemeal extermination of the breakout force, from which little if anything militarily usable would be saved, In addition, such an ignominious end would only add a blemish to what thus far had been a gallant defense. On May 4th, one of the senior staff officers working on the details of Albatross wrote a terse appreciation of Albatross, which well summed up the feeling of most of its colleagues. "Such an operation is both impossible and inconceivable. It strangely resembles the Battle of Sedan, 1870. GONO must continue to resist. It continues to tie down Viet Minh troops. Any command authority in Indochina which would sign such an order to take flight would dishonor itself." And in a final line that was obviously a reproach to the senior generals who had conceived, planned, and directed the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the note ended with the sentence, "One must know how to accept the consequences of one's acts." Finally, on May 7th at 10:00, as the Communist assault forces were within 200 meters of his command post, and his last reserves had been smashed in an all-out defense of the last portions of the eastern hills, de Castries decided to attempt Albatross. The dialogue between him and General Coigny over the radio telephone link was taped in its entirety. The part referring to Albatross reads as follows: "And then, mon Dieu, I'll attempt, if circumstances permit, to have the maximum of what I've got left scram southward." "Okay, understood. That will be at night, probably." "What? At night? Yes, General, at night, of course." "That's all right, yes. I need your approval to do it." "I approve, old man." "You are giving me that approval?" "I give you that approval." "Well, I'll hold. I'll try to hold here as long as possible with what is left over." They briefly spoke of other matters, and then Coigny returned to the subject of the breakout. "Okay. Well, about the withdrawal southward, how do you see it? Is it toward Isabelle or simultaneously in many directions?" "Well, General, in any case, they must push southward beyond Isabelle. Isn't that it?" "Yes, that's it. But I'll also give Isabelle the order to attempt to break out if they can." "Yes, that is understood. Well, keep me informed so that we can help you with a maximum of aviation for that business." There is, then, no question but that at the last moment de Castries did decide to attempt Albatross, but, of course, the order came far too late to be executed in an organized manner, and surviving senior officers told me that de Castries, anxious not to induce panic, had until the last moment refused to inform even many of the battalion commanders of the existence of such a plan. Isabelle, by virtue of its location closer to the southern edge of the valley, would have had a better chance at making good its escape. In its case, there was last-minute hesitation on the part of Colonel Lalande once he saw the destruction of the main position of Dien Bien Phu, and, once more apparently, there also was a last-minute attempt on the part of Hanoi to avoid taking responsibility. At 2100 of May 7th, there was a radio message from Colonel Lalande to the command aircraft number 545YA, piloted by the commander of the North Vietnamese bomber group, Lieutenant Colonel Dussol himself. The circling command aircraft had been acting as radio relay between Isabelle and Hanoi since the destruction of de Castries' own powerful radio sets at 1700. In his message, Lalande requested Hanoi to tell him whether the southern itinerary was still considered better, since, from his vantage point, a due west dash in the direction of Bon Loi seemed more favorable. In spite of repeated queries from the command aircraft, Hanoi never answered the question. A few minutes past midnight on May 8, 1954, the remnants of Thai subgroupment Weem and of the 12th Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Foreign Legion Regiment made a break for the hill line to the south. They got as far as the southern rim of the valley, and that is where Albatross died. 10. Castor dies. Saturday, April 24th, 1954. With the definitive loss of Huguet I, one half of the whole airstrip had fallen into Communist hands for good. Henceforth, there would be even less space for the supply drops, and the French and American pilots who flew the murderous supply runs would have to take even greater chances. During the night of April 23rd to 24th, another 72 volunteers had been parachuted into the main position, including replacements for the crews of the remaining tanks, who were being disabled at a faster rate than the vehicles in which they fought. This was to hold true again. Three sergeants and one private came in as tank crew replacements that night, but on April 26th, one sergeant and two soldiers became casualties, and on April 29th, Douaumont sustained a direct hit from a 105mm shell, which killed one man and wounded two. Among the latter was Private Lacree. He had been among the four tank crew replacements parachuted in on April 24th. That night also, 117 tons of supplies had been parachuted into the valley, of which about 99 tons fell into French lines. The lucky drop permitted the garrison to raise its supply level for most units to 2 days of food and about 5 days of ammunition, but at the price of numerous feats of heroism on the part of the transport crews, and notably the American pilots of the flying boxcars. In view of the ever-shrinking drop zones, the largely American-piloted C-119s had been compelled to fly lower and lower through the flak, and during the previous night, one of the boxcars had been hit by 2 37mm shells from a Soviet anti-aircraft gun. It had become common knowledge among the troops at Dien Bien Phu that the American civilian pilots were in many cases taking greater chances than the transport pilots of the French Air Force, flying mostly C-47s, and while the American pilots were being paid roughly $2,000 a month for their dangerous job, their contracts had not explicitly stated that they were to fly in an outright combat situation. It was therefore understandable that upon returning from their missions that day, they refused to continue to fly the Dien Bien Phu run. This decision was to have disastrous results, not only upon the Battle of Dien Bien Phu itself, but also upon Lieutenant Colonel Godard's Condor force groping its way toward Dien Bien Phu through the Laotian jungles. Cogny, as ground force commander in the north, did not have jurisdiction over the transport air force, yet he immediately requested General Navarre's permission to transfer French crews from the C-47s to the boxcars. For reasons known only to the military bureaucracy, Navarre's authorization to do so reached Cogny only on April 26th at 23:30. In the meantime, supply drops on Dien Bien Phu radically fell off. They averaged barely 60 tons a day during the next 3 days, and April 28th, a miraculously clear day in the midst of the monsoon season, was to provide the garrison of Dien Bien Phu with the depressing experience of receiving no supplies whatever. Saturday was also a day of stock-taking for the exhausted garrison and its commanders, and the picture which was transmitted in the form of an absolute priority telegram at 1400 showed that there were exactly 3,250 infantrymen left in some sort of fighting condition. In many cases, this meant that the men had lost one eye, and even one arm. Isabelle reported 1,400 riflemen still fit for combat. At Dien Bien Phu, Major Grouin's original 44-bed hospital had, with the help of the Moroccan combat engineers, spread its blood-soaked tentacles in all directions. A total of 878 seriously wounded men were now being cared for in the battalion dressing stations, in the hospital annexes manned by the airborne surgical teams, and in lightless burrows and shafts hastily dug along the communications trenches. Another 117 such wounded competed for living space on crowded Isabelle with the garrison, its field pieces, its ammunition depots, and its tanks. By now, then, the almost 15,000 men of the garrison fell into three fairly equal parts: the infantrymen, the artillerymen, and support troops from the various services. For to redistribute by hand over 100 tons of supplies a day and to care for 1,000 litter cases required a large number of non-combat personnel, and finally, the last third of the garrison of Dien Bien Phu, the dead, the men who had fallen into communist hands, and the rats of the Nam Yum. That morning also, intelligence had provided Dien Bien Phu with a revised estimate of the enemy's strength. Thanks to massive transfers of raw recruits, General Giap had succeeded in making up for most of his losses of the previous 2 months. Some of the new men, and the French were to take prisoners as late as May 2nd, had enlisted or had been drafted in mid-March, and had walked all the way to Dien Bien Phu in small 100-man reinforcement groups. Upon their arrival in the valley, they had been paired off with two veterans each, and these four-man cells had become the basic element of the reconstituted units, with the veterans in each cell being responsible for the on-the-spot combat training of the raw recruits. To be sure, such reconstituted units were far from having the deadly effectiveness of the Viet Minh assault outfits of mid-March, but Giap now again fielded 35,000 infantrymen against the French, or about 10 of his soldiers against every one of the gaunt and bone-weary Frenchmen, Vietnamese, and North Africans huddling in the mud holes of the French forward trenches. And as both the French staff and its communist counterpart knew, a 3-to-1 superiority of the assailant over the defender was a sufficient margin for victory in an assault. Another piece of bad news also had become available that morning. The French Air Force's 80th Overseas Reconnaissance Squadron had taken a full set of aerial photographs of the valley on the previous day at 12:30, and the fully interpreted photographs had been successfully dropped onto Castries headquarters. They clearly showed a strong tightening up of the deadly ring of 37mm anti-aircraft guns and of 50-caliber flak machine guns, particularly on the northeastern rim of the valley. A new battery of 105mm howitzers revealed itself on Anne-Marie, and several new batteries of 75mm howitzers were sighted 2 to 3 kilometers east of Isabelle. New communist batteries also had shown up behind Old Baldy and Phony Mountain on April 23rd, when they suddenly intervened with devastating effect on the paratroopers counterattacking on H1. On the other hand, no 120mm heavy mortars had been fired at Dien Bien Phu since April 19th. Probably something had gone wrong with the ammunition supply. This temporary lull did not particularly reassure the French, for they had been told by communist prisoners taken in recent days that special guns had been expected to arrive soon in the siege area. Some special 60 and 120mm shells had been picked up around Dien Bien Phu, but they had thus far not given French intelligence any clue as to what was to come. The solution to the mystery was still about 10 days away. There also remained some unfinished business from the aborted counterattack by Major Liesenfeldt's 2nd BEP. The remains of 1st and 2nd BEP formed the merged Foreign Legion Composite Paratroop Battalion under Major Giraud, which was assigned to the defense of what was left of Huguette, along with a company of 140 Moroccans of the 14 RTM under Captain Nicole. The badly mauled 2-1 RCP was again regrouped on the Elion Hills, but left a company of light wounded on Junot. Since its arrival during the first week of April, the battalion had lost 56 dead, 35 missing, 10 of whom were presumed dead, and 267 wounded. Particularly its 3rd and 4th companies had lost so many men that Bréchignac decided that morning to merge them into a single Compagnie de Marche, composite company, under Lieutenant René Leguerre. The loss of H1 also had had an effect upon Strongpoint Opera on the other side of the airfield. Opera had been specifically created to provide flanking protection for the northern segment of Huguette, and now found itself completely outflanked in turn. Longley and Bijard therefore decided to evacuate it before its small garrison suffered the fate of all the other overexposed strong points. In silence, French combat engineers mined Opera during the night of April 23rd to 24th, as its garrison, a company of the 5th Vietnamese paratroops under Captain Bizarre, slowly pulled back inside the airfield drainage ditch to a new fallback position 150 meters to the north of D4. In the words of Major Puget, the position had no name, perhaps because it was unnameable. Indeed, the monsoon rains had transformed the airfield drainage ditch into a veritable canal, filled in many places with waist-deep water. Yet, with the Dominique Hills on its right and Huguette 1 on its left under enemy control, it was sheer madness to attempt even to raise one's head above the rim of the ditch. Any man who was wounded had to be propped against the crumbling walls of the drainage ditch, and any man who died immediately sank out of sight. In that incredible place, Bizarre and his men, wet to the bone, worked like beavers in the most literal sense of the term, trying to dig firing positions into the soft mud and to construct a few sandbag bunkers in the ditch itself. Much of what they built that day was swept away the following night in a torrential rainstorm. Again like beavers, Bizarre and his Vietnamese reconstructed their strong point in the quagmire. They were to hold it through the last day of the battle. The day also witnessed an exchange of icily correct messages between Navarre and Cogny. The latter still argued that the vital Red River Delta was in mortal danger of being overrun, while Navarre felt that the situation, while critical in the Delta, was no more critical than that prevailing in the rest of Indochina. In a tone intended to be an ironical allusion to Cogny's preoccupation with Tonkin alone, Navarre informed the latter that he could be sure that I have informed government of exact situation from general Indochina viewpoint and not exclusive viewpoint Tonkin. In a no less biting style, Cogny replied later that day that he would not doubt that you have informed government of overall Indochina viewpoint and not exclusively Tonkin's. That is why, in order to complete said information, I have insisted reaffirming personal view believed to be different from yours on major points. Cogny once more argued the case for urgent reinforcements for Tonkin, as the preservation of the Red River Delta was vital for any future negotiation, regardless of the eventual fate of the garrison of Dien Bien Phu. At 22:20, Navarre sent yet another urgent message to Cogny, asking him to answer four precise questions: his estimate as to how long Dien Bien Phu could hold out with or without reinforcements, considering the enemy's current tactics; whether Cogny was in favor of reinforcing Dien Bien Phu; whether, should he be so inclined, he would advocate such reinforcements to take the form of individual volunteers or of constituted airborne battalions; and finally, whether Cogny was still in favor of carrying out Operation Condor, in spite of his reservations concerning the amount of respite it would bring to Dien Bien Phu. Cogny was to give his answer on the following day. Sunday, April 25, 1954. At 02:35, Captain Bizarre reported suspicious noises and digging around the blocking position north of the crossroads where Strongpoint Opera used to be. And in the early dawn, the outposts both of D4 and of the nameless Strongpoint in the drainage ditch began to report enemy infiltrations. But the terrain in that swamp was dishpan flat, and soon the French artillery pieces from Claudine began to hammer away at the enemy. The attacking force simply disappeared in the midst of geysers of mud. In all likelihood, more men drowned from the resulting panic than died from actually being hit by the shells. Despite the driving monsoon rains, which had fallen almost all night and whose waters had cascaded into every dugout and trench in the valley, the enemy had been extremely active. At 03:30, Brechignac's 2-1 RCP had reported intensive mortar shelling on top of E1, intermingled with hand grenades thrown by Viet Minh infantrymen in the forward trenches. By 6 o'clock in the morning, the enemy mortars gave way to communist artillery, which now took over the destruction of the last remaining bunkers on top of E1. Here also, the bone-weary French artillery and heavy mortar crews had to rush out into the open gun pits and lay down an intensive counter-battery fire, which finally somewhat slowed the cadence of Giap's guns. But the slim reserves of French artillery shells were running out fast. The remaining 2 155s fired 50 of their precious shells. The heavy mortars fired 200, and 750 shells were expended by the 105mm howitzers. The supply situation had now become catastrophic. A total of 63 tons of supplies, instead of the necessary minimum of 125, had been dropped in along with 51 reinforcements. One French-piloted C-119, the American crews having been withdrawn from the Dien Bien Phu run, misdropped its whole cargo of badly needed ammunition on the communist side. Hence, when news came from the outposts on the Elian Hills that the Viet Minh was installing new firing positions on Phony Mountain, Dien Bien Phu's artillery commander, Colonel Vallion, decided against shelling them. He would need all the ammunition he had on hand to fend off a serious attack, if it were to occur. In the midst of the shelling, the most exposed line units had to be relieved so as to permit them at least to have a warm meal, if not a moment of relative peace. On top of what was now called Elian Haute, or Upper Elian, and which comprised hills Elian 1-4, Brechignac had regrouped what was left of the 2-1 RCP, two companies of the 5th Vietnamese paratroops, two companies of Bizarre's old battalion, and Major Couton, who commanded what was left of the 113 Foreign Legion 2 over the defensive E2 under the jurisdiction of Brechignac. Over at Huguette, the Foreign Legion paratroopers under Major Guiraud also were frantically digging in, as infiltrations during the past night had shown that the Viet Minh were going to attempt the same tactics of stealthily digging forward that had already served them so well on the other Huguette positions. In the southwestern corner, Major Clemenceau also was using that Sunday to consolidate his positions on Claudine. Captain Bienvol, who had become surplus when his company of the 1st BEP had been dissolved for lack of troops, had taken over the command of the 3rd Composite Company of the 1-2 Foreign Legion on the previous day, and had taken a position at Claudine 4. Captain Capiron's 2nd Company of the 113 Foreign Legion, which had been detached from its battalion now stationed on Elian, took over the defense of C-5. All night long, much of the forward positions of Claudine had been under severe fire from mortars, grenade launchers, and snipers, and the diligent communist trench diggers had again done their work, despite the fact that the foreign legionnaires had plastered them with hand grenades and 60mm mortar shells. When dawn broke, the enemy had dug itself clear through the first line of barbed wire entanglements and was hard on the second and last barbed wire fence. Claudine, nonetheless, was under relatively less pressure than any of the other major strongpoints, and its patrols still succeeded in slipping through the enemy's siege ring into the open country. During the night of April 24th to 25th, one of the patrols of the 1-2 Foreign Legion had gone as far as Ban Koh Mai, 3 kilometers southwest of Dien Bien Phu. One may well wonder at the thoughts of those patrols as they looked back from the silence and darkness of their patrol area on the flame-limbed swamp that had